most histories of the American right begin shortly after the Second World War, and they culminate in Ronald Reagan's presidency. But when I wrote my book, The Right, I wanted to provide a wider angle on the history of the American right. When you begin the story much earlier and end it after Barack Obama, you find that Reagan is not the central character, but one character among many whose rise was not inevitable. The Republican Party of Donald Trump and Ron DeSantis has a lot in common with the Republican Party of the 1920s, Warren Harding and Calvin Coolidge. The American right prior to the Second World War stood for non-intervention in foreign policy, restriction of immigration into the United States, and a protectionist trade policy. The Republican Party under Donald Trump is against deploying troops overseas and illegal immigration to the United States. Trump called himself Tariff Man. The theme of my book, The Right, is the ongoing dynamic between conservative elites and the broader grassroots populist, revolting against expert wisdom, top-down governments, bureaucracy, and elite guardianship of institutions. Elites and the populace often find a common antagonism toward liberalism in American government, American culture, universities, in the entertainment industry, and in the media. Beginning in the mid-20th century, conservatives found that the way to get into power was the populist grassroots. But that didn't necessarily mean that the conservatives and the populists always saw eye to eye. During the Cold War, anti-communism provided a foundation for an alliance between the conservatives and the populists. After the Cold War, many of the fissures between conservatives and the populist grassroots came to the fore. The issue of immigration, simmering discontent with George W. Bush's policy of regime change in Iraq and Afghanistan, and the integration of China into the global economy. This tension between conservative elites and the Republican populist grassroots grew with time and eventually culminated in the rise of Donald Trump, who was the agent of populist revolt, not only against liberal elites, but also against conservative ones. And that's where we find ourselves today.
Conservatives do not all agree on the major political issues of the day. Views evolve as constituencies change and social norms evolve. Each party is desperate to get to 51%. The Democratic Party changed its political position over time as well. Just take immigration. Cesar Chavez opposed immigration because Mexican laborers would undercut wages of his union workers.
Well, I would say there's more coherence on the Democratic side on immigration. There was a change in the attitude of unions toward immigration in the last 20 years when unions saw immigration as a threat to wages of their members. The Republican Party, there is still a debate between the business community, which does favor relaxed immigration policy, and the populist Republicans rooted against immigration.
The Republicans are sore that the compromise from Reagan's immigration legislation that traded border enforcement for expanded citizenship wasn't enforced by Democratic presidents. So I suspect that the Republicans would prefer to do nothing.
I think that's an accurate statement of the Republican position. The last time there was an amnesty authorized by Congress for illegal immigrants, it was under Ronald Reagan. And Reagan said that the border enforcement and employer enforcement ought to be followed, and they were not, as you mentioned. And that has made many Republicans and opponents of immigration very leery of a deal that would regularize the status of illegal immigrants. I just don't see the possibility of any compromise. I don't see any Republicans even wanting to address the legal status of people residing here unauthorized.
The next topic is foreign policy. The Republicans included both isolationists and internationalists in the party leadership over the past 100 years. Senator Lodge opposed the League of Nations, and Trump wanted to bring the troops home and reduce our obligations under the alliances. In contrast, Eisenhower and Bush were true believers in the role of NATO and multilateral institutions to keep the peace. Let's look at the Democrats. In the 1960s, LBJ started the Vietnam War, while McGovern protested foreign wars. Both political parties' positions are inconsistent in foreign policy.
It is on the issue of foreign policy where you find the greatest diversity of opinion within both parties. And I think that's been true throughout the history. The Cold War established within the Republican Party what one scholar calls engaged nationalism, a foreign policy that's nationalistic, believes in American hard power, and that America shouldn't be tied down by multilateral organizations like the United Nations. America should have troops stationed overseas to meet threats in Europe and East Asia. The engaged nationalists believed in alliances like the NATO alliance, in free trade to empower our allies through economic growth, but also to hold up America as a model of democracy for the world. These were all policies generally agreed upon within the conservative movement during the Cold War period. It's before the Cold War, when you didn't have the threat of the Soviet Union, and after the Cold War, when the Soviet Union is removed from the equation, that figures like Buchanan revert to a disengaged nationalist foreign policy, still nationalistic, still believing in American power, in American freedom of action, but disengaged from the world. No forward defense, no alliances, protectionist in economics, closed to immigration. The George W. Bush foreign policy of preemptive war and regime change intensified those differences, made this discussion more vitriolic within the party. On the Democratic side, Bill Clinton seized on that unipolar moment when America was the sole superpower to engage in a variety of humanitarian interventions, believing in multilateralism, international organizations and alliances. There's been a retreat from that position on the Democratic side that is more like the McGovern position you mentioned earlier. One of the reasons I wrote my book, The Right, is to push back against the idea that the right is just one thing. People take the figure of Reagan, they think he's the standard of the American right, that he's the model, everyone should follow him, or they need to deviate from him. My point is, he's one model. There are many different schools of conservatism, and they have often competed for dominance within the right. And we've seen a transition in recent years between engaged nationalists being dominant and the Trump group taking the reins of power.
The voter composition of the Republican Party changes over time. Vermont used to be very Republican, and now New England is solidly Democratic. College-educated elites used to be at the center of the Republican Party. Today, non-college-educated whites vote 2-1 Republican and are core to the party. I think we should expect Republican policies to follow the interests of its primary constituents.
Yes, I think that's right. There's no doubt that the growth of the non-college-educated vote within the Republican Party has been incredibly consequential for American politics. The migration of non-college educated voters from Democrats to Republicans is what has fueled populism on the right. My American Enterprise Institute colleague, Michael Barone, published a book before the pandemic on the two parties. And he said the groups of people who compose the two parties have changed over time. But fundamentally, the two parties have always stood for a certain type of American, with the Republican Party representing the people who feel as though they are the true American community, and the Democratic Party composed of outgroups.
Michael Barone spoke at one of my book clubs a couple years ago about his book, which you reference, How America's Political Parties Change and How They Don't. And my takeaway from Barone is that immigrants' national origin and religion matter for current voting patterns. The fact that Wisconsin and Minnesota were settled by Norwegians and Swedes affects their current voting behavior and differs from the German Catholics who settled near Milwaukee, as an example.
The real value in what Barone does is look at ethnicity and religiosity rather than looking at the white vote. We can disaggregate it and we can look at, as you said, the descendants of German Americans, Swedes, and then trace their voting patterns over time. Ethnicity is a much more interesting lens to look at American politics than the reductive frame of race. The other thing he does is look at religiosity. The real change came beginning in the 1970s when it was less what religion you were than how often did you practice it. This idea that church attendance or temple or mosque attendance is the real metric that's going to show where you're going to fall politically is an important transformation in American politics.
Your book, The Right, explores the evolving intellectual policy debates in the context of the political environment.
My book is unique because it tries to synthesize the ideas with the politics. I try to weave what the intellectuals were doing with the major developments in American politics during this 100-year period. The decomposition of the New Deal coalition over Vietnam and the civil rights movement after the 1964 Civil Rights Act and the 1965 Voting Rights Act is the major story of the 20th century politics. Were they reacting to ideas? Well, it's not as though they were picking up Ludwig von Mises and saying, oh, I'm a Republican now. No. What they were reacting to was the rise of the anti-war movement over Vietnam, the student revolt on campuses, rising crime in the cities, and the squeeze on wages because of inflation. The most receptive audience was the hard hats. That's where you see this dynamic between the conservative intellectuals and populist voters, those construction workers at the World Trade Center who fought the anti-war protesters in the so-called hard hat riot. Nixon loved the hard hats. Whether you call them middle American radicals, or you call them the silent majority, or you call them the Reagan Democrats, they have provided the votes for Republican majorities over the last 50-some years.
What do you make of Tom Frank's argument made in his book, What's Wrong with Kansas, that suggests that the Kansas voter makes a mistake by voting against his personal interests?
The thesis is that social conservative voters don't know what's in their economic interests. Voters find values issues more important than economic ones. The political takes preference over the economic. If the voters in Kansas vote Republican because they think that the Republican Party is on their side on the right to life or the Second Amendment rights, that makes as much sense to me as it does suburbanites in Northern Virginia voting for the Democratic Party that is a strong supporter of civil rights and of rights for LGBTQ Americans. Values matters. They matter to both sides and usually take priority over economics.
You make the argument in your book that intellectual but not scholarly magazines like Commentary, The Weekly Standard, The National Review, and American Affairs are critical to the conservative movement. I've subscribed to Commentary magazine since I was in high school, but very few people read it. Why do you think that these intellectual magazines have such outsized influence if politically interested people and politicians do not read them?
People don't read the little magazines. They're also not reading the great works that those magazines popularize. They may not have heard of Milton Friedman, Norman Podhoretz, or Irving Kristol, or Leo Strauss, for that matter. But the magazines filter these ideas in ways that make them more accessible to people who are involved in politics. You're right, most people in politics don't read these little magazines. Some people do. I mean, you read it, Larry. Enough politicians read them to draw ideas, and they get a policy proposal out of them. And so it's important that way. The little magazines are directionally the barometer of what the climate of opinion, as Milton Friedman used to call it, is at a given moment. During Trump's presidency, other magazines came into existence to explain and influence the Trump administration, journals such as American Affairs. The Claremont Review of Books is now central to the Trump world and continues to rise in popularity.
Readers of Commentary magazine and the Weekly Standard would have been shocked by Trump's rise to power and the political issues that pushed him forward in his presidential campaign. Many of Trump's ideas on foreign policy, trade, and immigration were vehemently opposed by the conservative intellectual writers for these magazines.
I agree. For someone who had just been reading Commentary, the Weekly Standard, or National Review and its Against Trump issue in 2016, the Trump victory would be a surprise. Trump was a master at social media and leveraging the social media power to advance his political prospects.
Next topic, conservative talk radio, led by Rush Limbaugh, has more listeners and influence than these political magazines.
Yeah, that's right. The important thing about Limbaugh, his audience might not have read those publications, but he did. Rush was very well aware of what was going on the intellectual scene. Rush Limbaugh is an incredibly important figure in my story. Many people master an industry. Very few people create the industry that they master. And that's what Rush did. Rush Limbaugh created nationally syndicated talk radio and found a huge audience. Tens of millions of people were receptive to it. And he also had unique talents as an entertainer who, as I said, was very conversant with ideas. Rush was taking the articles published in these journals and filtering them, popularizing, spreading them to an even larger audience.
One of the great conservative intellectuals of the period is Milton Friedman. He had many policy recommendations. Some got implemented, like eliminating the draft in favor of a volunteer military. Friedman also recommended a negative income tax to reduce the disincentives for work, but it had no support among Democrats at the time. Recently, Andrew Yang is using a similar concept with a universal basic income, but it is now unanimously opposed by the Republicans.
I would say that the negative income tax example was influential in the development of the earned income tax credit. Friedman proposed this as a substitute for the welfare state rather than a supplement. And I think Andrew Yang has been perhaps strategically ambiguous in answering the question of whether his proposed UBI would replace the welfare state in its entirety or simply be another add-on. And you're right to say there is no way Republicans would support another welfare entitlement. However, if one could replace our welfare state with a cash grant that would cover all expenses, I think actually a lot of people on the right would be receptive to that.
In your book, you discuss the influence of the conservative academic Harry Jaffa. Why is he an important conservative intellectual?
Harry Jaffa wrote one of the most important books in American political thought. It's called Crisis of the House Divided, and it's a study of the Lincoln-Douglas debates. I recommend it to everyone. It is an amazing work. It reestablishes Lincoln as a political philosopher. After that book, he became interested in politics, Harry Jaffa, penned Barry Goldwater's famous line, "Extremism in the defense of liberty is no vice," from the 1964 Republican convention, a line that was among the many reasons that Barry lost that election. He eventually settled on the idea that America was the greatest, that America is the synthesis of classical and modern philosophy, and anything that goes against Lincoln and the founders will lead us down the primrose path to totalitarianism.
American exceptionalism is a fundamental idea for conservatives, which is in sharp contrast to Barack Obama, who said that American exceptionalism is as true as Greek exceptionalism.
The right has long believed in American exceptionalism, and what made the American unique was the founding. It didn't emerge from tribal warfare and ancestral kings. It was the first time it had been done on this scale in human history, and especially these principles proclaimed in the Declaration, the idea that all men are created equal, that the king has no right, was a revolutionary concept that Americans introduced to the world. The American conservative movement said that's something to be defended, the American founding, and the constitutional order, which protects individual liberty. Obama, very interestingly, went against the tradition of American presidents. Rah, 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 America, we're exceptional. Obama was the first to say, I believe it in the same way that the Greeks think they're exceptional. It provided a clue to where American politics was headed. Because when you look at American politics today, we're not really arguing over the size and scope of the state. Instead, what we're arguing over is what it means to be an American. Who counts as an American? What is American history? What are the lessons that we're supposed to draw from it? Does American exceptionalism exist? Whose values ought to rule?
Conservatives focus on the role of institutions instead of group identity, the importance of the church, business, the military, and thousands of smaller but important institutions like the United Way or the League of Women Voters. Society is centered around the family and not the state. Conservatives fight for these institutions. Changes to them should be incremental because of respect for the way that institutions are managed. There must be a reason institutions work the way they do because of life's complications and are not obvious. In contrast, the liberal view has attributes from the French Revolution that radical change can solve intractable problems. Damn the institutions.
Right. Conservatism is associated with defense of inherited institutions. In American context, what institutions are those? We don't have a king. We don't have an established church. We don't have an aristocracy. We do have the American founding. We do have the American family, civil society, and the market. There's always been a tension between conservatism and populism that is often anti-institutional, that wants its will imposed immediately.
In the fall of 2021, in the Virginia governor election, public schools and education was an important political topic. The Republican Youngkin argued that content and the curriculum should be determined by parents. while the Democratic candidate said this decision-making should belong with the teacher and education experts. And this debate highlights the differences between the role of parents versus bureaucratic experts.
Youngkin is on the side of parents who are disgusted at the way schools handled the pandemic and things taught in schools. He doesn't have Trump's personality. He's not as combative as DeSantis. He's a potential model for Republican leaders. We can do it with a smile and a fleece vest, and that can go a long way.
The biggest surprise in the political world in the election of 2020 was the changing voting patterns of Hispanics as they joined the Republican Party.
Hispanic voters care about the same thing as voters everywhere. They want a growing economy, safe streets, good schools. They want affordable health care and child care. And what they saw under Trump was rising paychecks, jobs, and an economy that was recovering pretty quickly after the pandemic shock. There are plenty of people who showed up here legally 30 years ago who claim Hispanic ancestry who are infuriated that people are just walking over the border and they want to deal with illegal immigration. I think the Hispanic voter is in the same position as the hardhats in the 60s and early 1970s. Because of assimilation into America, they are now more aligned with the Republican Party, mainly because they begin to reject the excesses of liberalism and the left.
I end each episode on a note of optimism. Matt, what are you optimistic about?
I'm optimistic about our Constitution and the political institutions it created. They've been through a lot of stress in recent years, a profound stress, and they have survived. It's the role of American conservatives to defend them, not to look to a single person, a specific figure or a personality, but to preserve it against its challengers, which can come from both the left and the right.